accent, even by U.S. standards. If you have any trouble understanding me, just raise your hand, ask me to repeat, and I will do so, okay? It's really funny, though, is whenever I travel around, people don't realize I'm from the United States because of my accent. It's kind of weird. Everybody expects Southerners to sound like John Wayne. I hope I don't sound like that. Only you can tell, because to me, I sound normal. I can't believe so many people are awake this morning. Wasn't there a party last night, like the Geek Night? Is there going to be a timer right there?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, I assume all you guys are C-sharp developers, right? Because we are in a C-sharp session. Okay. I've had this mistake before where I've shown up and given a C-sharp talk and the entire audience turned out to be VB coders. I didn't realize it until about 20 minutes into it. No one had asked me any questions and the audience had a confused look on their face. And eventually someone raised their hand and asked me how they could tell when the curly braces ended. So... you never know what you will get. Life is like a box of chocolates, right? Exactly. Hey, that park bench is only about an hour away from where I live. You know, yes. I think that was filmed in Georgia, and I live in South Carolina, and they're right next to each other. Of course, our states are about the size of your countries here. Take forever to drive across. And we have poor public transportation, so you have to get a car. If you ever come to the U.S., you have to get a car. Winnebago. If you're going to drive across the country. Looking for the time. It's going to be standing room only in here. It's amazing. You guys need to banter with me a little bit, because otherwise I just stand here looking funny until this thing turns on. So this is my first time in the Netherlands. Yes. It's been pretty cool so far. I mean, it's a really nice country. Yeah. I haven't seen it. That's just about it. I'm going to be here tomorrow, though, so I'm going to go out and try to take something in. Amsterdam. I should go to Amsterdam. It's only a train ride away, right? I don't have to rent a car. No Winnebagoes to get to Amsterdam. That's true. There's some cool cars there. Like, I saw some Peugeot thing that looked really cool. I think that's how you pronounce it. I'm not sure. a car that we don't have in the U.S. It was a really cool car. It had a little lion on the front of it. Oh. French car, oh. You guys have make cars here? Ferraris? I saw one of those as well. So, yeah. So the horse rearing up, right? I think I saw one of them a few days ago, but that was in Belgium at the time.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think I don't sell Ferraris here. They're too expensive.
Uh-huh.
Thanks.
You should see what we buy in America, these gigantic trucks that no one needs, but yes, you have to get one because if you don't and one hits you, you're done for. Like it's about time. Okay, welcome to the session, everyone. It's been a nice morning. We're going to be talking about declarative refactoring. My name's Chris Urgel. My Twitter handle's down below, and I work for Telerik. So you're probably wondering, what is this session all about? It's a C-sharp session, so if you program in VB, a lot of the principles will still apply, and you can use them. In fact, they apply in most languages. However, we are going to be doing all the examples in C-sharp. And the purpose of this demo is to tell you how to code for what, not how. We're going to get away from imperative code where everything is described how you're doing it, and instead go to more declarative code that describes what you're doing. The purpose of this is to make your code more readable, make cleaner code. And by extension, we're going to make our code more maintainable. So I'm going to jump straight into code because this is a C-sharp session. I know you guys are developers and you love to see code, right? All right. So the first thing we're going to do is start off with some basic declarative programming. I have here a factory method called create ninja. Imagine a game like ninjas versus pirates, okay? So we need to create the ninja, and of course, if you have a ninja and ninjas versus pirates, hopefully they have some pirates killed. And we're going to give him some type of clothing. He could be sneaking around, needs to wear civilian type clothing, or he could have that traditional ninja outfit. So this is the way a typical factory method would look in imperative code. We're going to create the ninja, assign some values to the properties like ninja.name. By the way, Sarutobi Suzuki is a legendary ninja from Japanese folklore. Did a little bit of research. Just a little bit. Okay, so then we're going to load them up with some weapons, a katana, a shuriken, and a bow. And we're going to add them to the weapons and assign it to the weapons. Now, since it is a legendary ninja, he must have killed at least one pirate. So if pirates is less than one, we're going to assign one. So someone can't use the factory method to create some ninja who's killed negative one pirates. Doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And like I say, needs at least one. And the other portion is if somebody passes in clothes and it's null, well, we don't want our ninja to run around naked. So we're going to give him the clothing.shizuku. So the first thing to make your code declarative, and this is particularly the case when you're writing test code, you need to create an object graph to test on, is we're going to change this to use object initializers. So instead of assigning this ninja.name, we can now copy it and put it inside here. Actually, before I finish this, let me copy this method right here and paste it, because I want you to see the difference before and after. All right. So you can tell me which one you would prefer. The declarative way of doing it, showing the object graph, and using some of the operators, or the imperative way of doing it. Because I think that seeing the code really illustrates it side by side. So we're going to set up this object initializer. We're going to set the name so we can get rid of this. Actually, down to here. And the next thing we want to do is assign the weapons. Now we're creating three of them and assigning them to the collection. So we're going to use a collection initializer. Alright, I need to put a comma there. And we're going to just copy new weapon, weapon type dot katana, put it in here. And then maybe we'll just do the same thing, and I'll just replace them. Alright, dot shuriken and dot bow. This allows us to get rid of this big chunk of code right here that's really unnecessary. And next, we're going to do the pirate skills less than one. We're going to assign it to one. Otherwise, we're going to assign it to pirate skill. Now, the reason I have a problem with this is because anytime you encounter an if statement, you have to immediately think about what are the conditions, and then what's going to happen if those conditions are met. In this case, the only thing we care about doing is assigning this one property. So I am going to use the ternary operator to do that. And I'm going to copy the condition out of here. I'll put the question mark. And so if it's less than one, then we want to assign one. Otherwise, we want to do pirates killed. So I want to make one note about the ternary operator. And that is that there are two schools of thought on the ternary operator. There are some people who say you should never use it. They see some people agreeing with that. So there's some people who say you should never use it, and the reason they say you should never use it is because people don't understand it. It's too hard to read. My counter would be is that back in the day, people would say don't use object-oriented programming because people don't understand object-oriented programming. If you never use the operator, no one's going to understand it, of course. The other school of thought is that you should use it all the time. Well, I have a problem with using it all the time because it can make your code unreadable. And that's if you have long methods or it's doing too much work. However, in the case of a simple assignment, I think it's perfectly acceptable to use. And in fact, I can actually, you know, see that this is pirates killed. The only reason I even care to look inside of here is if it's wrong, right? I do not have to evaluate that if statement. So now I can cut this out. And the last one is the clothes. So this is a nullable type. As you can see, we're passing in clothing question mark. It's the same thing as nullable clothing. And whenever we encounter this, you can check the dot has value to see if it has a value or if it's null. And in this case, if it does have a value, we're going to assign the value. Otherwise, we're going to assign a default value. Again, this is something that I consider a little unnecessary to do, and some people don't realize that you can do this, but you can just type in close equals close question mark clothing.shizuku. That's the null coalescing operator. If the thing on the left is null, it's going to take the thing on the right, and you can chain these together. And this is also useful for calling factory methods. If I have a property that is null, I can say whatever.property equals whatever.property ?? Some factory method. Okay, so now I can cut this out. It's doing the exact same thing. And we're left with this. Well, I am creating this ninja variable. I don't actually need this ninja variable anymore. I can just say return new ninja and get rid of it. So this is the way our method now looks. Return new ninja. Then we have the object graph. It's very plain, easy to see. If I scroll down, this is the way it looked before. So I have to ask you, which would you prefer to use? The first one? I mean, you want to see it again? No, the top one. Okay, the top one. You want to see the top one. Right. So whenever you're creating object graphs, this is the way to go. And all the operators, of course, you can use in other contexts. Now, being declarative is more than just using operators and using object initializers. I am going to open up names matter, because the names do matter. Can anyone tell me what in the world this does? Let me run it. 6. You guys like that, huh? It should be 42. Maybe I'll give you a better idea of what it does if I put in 4 and run it. 10. No, not Fibonacci. See, names do matter. If you don't name things properly, no one's going to understand it. And then they have to go inside this mess and figure out what that means. So if I actually name this X and I name this factorial, it now makes a lot more sense. I have a lambda expression saying X goes into, so whatever variable we pass into it or whatever number we pass into it, if X is less than or equal to 1, then it's going to be 1. Otherwise, we're going to return X plus factorial, it's a recursive function, minus minus X. Names do matter. I only care that this is a factorial and it works. I don't care what's over here, as long as it works. So back over to the declarative refactoring demo. The next step that you need to realize is that not only is the assignments and the operators, the if statements, all this is imperative code that makes things hard to read, there's also loops. Anytime you see a loop, you have to wrap your mind around it. What is this loop doing? If it's creating one collection and looping through another and adding items from one to the other, you have to figure out what context that's in. And that takes time to debug. So we're going to go to my right neck of ninjas, because I have a ninjas method. And this ninja method returns an enumerable of ninja. And I have ninja 1, ninja 2, and I have some ninjas without clothes on. Well, that's unfortunate, so I want to find them in this collection, or this sequence. So I have my right neck of ninjas. And I'm going to create this list of neck and ninjas. I'm looping through it for each ninja, ninja, and ninjas. And if it doesn't have a value, I'm going to add it to the other collection. And then we're going to write it out to the screen just so you can see that it works. Let me go up to main. Okay, so it does work. Nothing was really in doubt there. So what I'm going to do here is I'm going to comment this out. I'm going to say var ninjas dot where. Because the only thing I care about doing is filtering that sequence. So the where or anytime you have a lambda, whenever you're using a where, select, or anything that takes in some type of function, the lambda variable is the same thing as this right here. You can think of it like that. I can say ninja, to name it, goes into. So we're saying basically for each ninja and ninja, you know, this is the variable name. And I'm going to say not ninja.close.hasValue. So I'm taking the filter that was inside of here, and I'm doing it inside of the where clause, inside of the lambda. All right. Let's see if it still works. Cool. Still works. This is, of course, more declarative, because if I had it chained together with order by or with select to project it from one thing to another, it would be difficult to read. You would have collections floating around, many if statements. So basically, link will clean up your code very well. I definitely recommend going with link over doing for each loops. And I'm going to show you a way to get rid of this for each loop later on. So if you notice that one thing in the link statement is that I could call this sequence dot something, and it would return me another sequence. And then I could call another method on the sequence. I could call dot select or dot order by. That is a fluent interface. So over here, I have a clan, the Super Ninja clan. And it has four ninjas in it. If we take a look at this, I'm only exposing ninjas as an IEnumerable, even though internally I'm keeping it as a list. This is because I don't want people writing to this list without the contained object knowing about it. It violates encapsulation. And the reason this is important is because if we have more than four ninjas, well, the ninja we're adding might be a pirate infiltrating our clan, right? This is pretty simple, but we want to turn this into a more fluent interface. So I have add ninja, and to make this fluent, I want to keep the same context. Now, you can change context if you need to. However, I prefer to keep the same context because it adds more flexibility to your frameworks. So to make this work, we need to return clan. And we're going to return this. Now, the problem with using add is it's a well-known term that means add something to a collection and it's void. So we want to use something that's a more fluent term, and I'm going to use with, because really we're saying that this clan with a ninja. Now keep in mind we're making a very simple fluent interface, and fluent interfaces can be difficult to make. It does add a little bit more time to develop your code. However, it gives you an internal DSL that will make it easier for your developers to use. So now I have this problem that my clan.addNinja doesn't work. So I am going to get rid of the semicolon, select this. Actually, I want to select all the way out to here. I'm going to say dot with ninja. Get rid of these. Great. So now when I create the clan, I'm declaring at the time of the creation that this clan is with this ninja, with this ninja, with this ninja. Yes. Okay, so that's a cool trick, so I'll show you how. You hold down the Alt key, select it with your mouse, and then you can just start typing. In fact, you can select a column like this. It's a cool trick, I admit. All right. Let's write them out. Ro, Bo, Johto, and Mote. I should mention one other thing. If I had originally been exposing a list, and I changed it to be IEnumerable, and I tried to pass it this write ninjas method, it would have failed. So it's very important when the only thing that you're doing is iterating over a collection and your methods, except IEnumerable T, or IEnumerable of Ninja in this case, because it's the most general interface, and the only thing that we care about doing with this is looping over it. In fact, I would say that IEnumerable T is very important because link works in IEnumerable T, and many of the things that you used to do with regular collections, ever since 2008, you no longer need to do. You can call the link statements instead. So I'm going to talk about the killer for Fluent interfaces, and that's out parameters. I despise out parameters. I consider them an anachronism. They're still necessary if you're calling into a legacy library. If you're calling into C++, you're probably going to have to use out parameters. But oftentimes they are abused. You don't really need them as much. So I want to talk about a way to get rid of these. And to do that, I have a div method. Div 7,3. Out quotient, out remainder. And we've declared the quotient remainder. We're going to write it out. Now 7,3. Let's see what we get here. Let's make sure it actually works. Quotient 2, remainder 1. Goes into it 2 times. We have a remainder of 1. So if we look at the div method, I have a contract saying that divisor cannot be equal to 0. And then it's very simple. We're just saying the quotient and the remainder using the appropriate operators. Now, C# is an object-oriented language. Whenever you have out parameters, you're saying that I need 2 values return, or more than 1 value return, technically. So in an object-oriented programming language, what should you do? Huh? I was going to get there. You're jumping ahead a little bit, just a little bit. So in a purely object-oriented programming language, think back original C#. It's purely object-oriented, didn't have many of the functional aspects it has today. You would have created a div result struct. Div result struct would have 2 properties on it, quotient and remainder. There isn't really much need to demonstrate that. I'll just show the div result class. Whenever you have a struct, you're basically saying this represents 1 value, and it should be immutable, so you should make everything read-only. Now, if it's too large, more than 16 bytes, or doesn't represent a single atomic value, you really should use a class rather than a struct. But the reason you would take this route, even with the other options I'm getting ready to show you, is if you have operations you want to add to it. In this case, you know, I've got many of the operators that we need, and I've done some crazy thing with valid for result, return IEnumerable tuple int, comma int. This isn't so necessary for what we're trying to do, which is write things out to a screen. So let's talk about some other ways to do this, but being lightweight. And somebody already ruined the first one, yeah. And that is tuple, or tuple. There's a big clash over how you should pronounce it, right? I don't really care. Pronounce it how you will. It's all good. So whenever you have more than one type being returned, a tuple is really the best way to describe it. And to do a tuple, we're going to get rid of the out int quotient, out int remainder. And we need to return tuple int, comma int. I'm going to rename this to Q for now, and this to R. And then I just need to call the factory method tuple.create Q, R, and it's created. It's using generic inference to determine the types. If I had passed a string into one of these parameters, it would have been a tuple int, string. Okay, so now we have a tuple, and I'm going to say var result equals div 7,3, and we can get rid of the out parameters now. I can get rid of these variables. And we have console.writeline quotient and remainder. So we need to change this to result the item ones. This is what I don't like about tuples and C#. It's great they introduced the classes inside of the .NET framework, but they were really meant for some, you know, more functional type of languages. So result.item1, result.item2, and it will still work. Let's run it. 2, 1. What I would like to see in the future, this isn't around, but what I would like to see is something that's more from the other languages, which is tuple support in C#. So I could say, let's see, quotient, comma, remainder, equals div, comma, 3. Basically say unpack the values into these two variables. Unfortunately, C# does not have good tuple support at the moment. So I would recommend avoiding it unless it just happens to fit your situation perfectly. There is something from .NET 3.5, or actually C# 3, I should say, that's very similar to a tuple. Anybody have any ideas? No? That is true. That is a tuple. Something else. No. The other thing that's very similar is anonymous types. Very, very similar to tuples. So I'm going to get rid of this. I'm going to say object. Div. I'm going to say return new. And I can use that object initializer we saw earlier, but I'm not actually saying what type it is. I'm just going to give it some names. And this is why it is very similar to a tuple, and that is that instead of having item 1 and item 2, we actually name all the all the properties on it. So remainder equals R. There's one problem. How am I getting it out of the method? What's that? Reflection. Back in the day, we'd use reflection. There's a new way to do it in .NET 4. Dynamic. Yes. We can call this dynamic. And now my var result actually has a quotient and a remainder on it. 2 and 1. There's a problem with this. Yes, what happens if I mistype something? Boom! It still compiles. At runtime, I get an exception. So if you use dynamics, you need to have good unit tests to make sure everything works. All right. There's another way to get an anonymous type out of here. It isn't truly getting it out of the method. Instead, we're using like an inversion of control on our method. We're saying, method, this is what I want. Give it to me. So we're going to copy this. By the way, you shouldn't copy and paste your code. Just be aware of that. I'm in a demo. It's okay. Okay, I'm going to return T, because the method doesn't know what type it's going to be. So I'm going to use the generic here. We're going to assign T. And what we're going to do is we're going to pass in another parameter. The parameter is going to be a continuation. In this case, it's going to be func int, comma int, comma T. We're basically saying quotient and remainder goes into some type. We're going to return some type out of it. Funk. All right. I'm going to cut this, and I'm going to call func q comma r. So I can call the function at the tail end of the method. This allows me to take my anonymous type up here. I actually need to declare the variables. Okay, so now I'm going to say quotient remainder goes into, and then give me this. I want a new object with quotient remainder. I don't really need to do anything else with it but get these two values out of it. Obviously, I have the red squigglies. It is type safe. If I try to compile it, it won't. Build failure. The I there, now I can run it. Continuation passing style. Okay, so that's cool, but the only thing I'm doing is writing it out to the screen. You don't really need to get a type out of here. And by the way, you don't need to create an anonymous type like that. You could just say Q, I just need the quotient out there of it, or I need the remainder, or I want to do something bizarre like add them together. But what we're going to do is we're going to overload this div method to accept an action instead. So we can still use the func version to get a T out, whatever type the person wants. But we can just say, do this. Here's what I want you to do with the variables. Keep with the naming conventions. I'm going to name this action. Need to get rid of the generic. This is now void. I'm going to call action Q, R. And I don't need to return anything, of course, because it's void. So now that we've, okay, just so you understand, we've changed this. We can still use the func version, but we've changed this to have an action, and we're going to call the continuation at the tail end to do something rather than to return something. So I can go back to the top here. And what I can do is I can get rid of this result. I have Q, R goes into, put this at the top. Making a multi-line lambda. This is starting to look kind of ugly. Okay. We're calling div 7, 3, Q, R. We can pass or change this to Q. Change this to R. And we should be good. 2 and 1. Okay. I don't really like this too much. It's not very declarative. It's a multi-line lambda. So let's give it a name. Let's name the lambda. Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to come down here. We're going to say public static, because I'm using the console application. Public static void write results. Int Q, int R. Of course, you should actually name those if you do this. And now I'm going to cut this out. Paste this in. And we're writing out the same thing we were doing before. But now I can come up here and get rid of all this and just say write results. Pretty cool. I have a reusable method as well. Be very careful if you do something like that. If you have name methods, the compiler is going to convert it to a delegate. If you are using something like link to SQL, link to entity framework, link to anything that uses expression trees, it will not use that version. It will use the link to objects version. Instead, you would actually need to go down here and make this return an expression tree of the appropriate type. So this works really great when you're dealing with normal link to objects, not so well with link to entity framework or any other type of link to X that uses iQueryable. Okay, so I know what you're thinking. Like, sometimes I need out parameters. What about triparse? Everybody uses triparse, right? How in the world do you get rid of the out parameter from triparse? I mean, it's so clean. I just call triparse request.query string index and, you know, get it out. And if it doesn't return true, then I'm going to assign a default, or excuse me, if it doesn't return a number, I'm going to assign a default value. Now, if it's 0, it's the default value for integer, it works out that you don't actually need the if statement. But if I assigned 1 up here, it would change it to 0 if this failed. So I was thinking to myself, I can get rid of this. Don't really like outparameters. I think there's a cleaner way of doing it. Of course, there is convert, and I do like the syntax for convert. Convert dot to int 32 looks really nice. What happens if the if it messes up or if it doesn't convert it? Exception. It's just as ugly. In fact, it's even worse because it will consume so many resources by throwing an exception. So, how about maybe? Maybe it's an int 32. Maybe it isn't. Okay. Now, I set maybe to be a nullable type. We're doing value types in these parsing operations, so it can be a nullable int or a nullable float or a nullable whatever the value type is. If it doesn't convert, of course the value should be null. And then I can check for that if I need to log an error. However, if I don't care, I can just put 1. You know, I'm going to say, if this doesn't convert, maybe it's not an int 32, then make it a 1. So I'm going to show you my reason, or the way I do things. Whenever I think about refactoring things to make them a little more declarative, a little more readable, I usually just wrap up whatever ugly code it is in another method. As you can see here, it's just calling triparse. Don't repeat yourself. If you have too many lines of code, then move them somewhere else. Encapsulate it in another method. All right. So we covered that. The other thing you should do is try to avoid side effects, particularly when dealing with fluent interfaces. So, I have a buggy code because I was writing an extension method in iNumerable T, and I discovered it myself because it didn't really click. I think I knew it a long time ago, but I'd never really come across this problem. And if I call this strings, new list of strings, this is and I call find the bug takes in the iList of string. And then I'm going to add, a new string to it. And it says this is a fail. And there's a problem with this if you're writing a framework. If I run this code, it works fine. This isn't the problem. This isn't going to fail on me right here. Does anybody have an idea of what's wrong with this method? And I see this in so many frameworks out there. Someone will take in an iList or an iCollection. It doesn't need to be iList. We're just adding something to it. And they're not checking something that's very vital. Oh, strings can't be null because I have the contract out requires right here to check that. Need to hold the value for the backing field. No, there's actually something that will cause this to break. Strings can be what? I'm sorry? Read only. Oh, yeah, you're on the right track. What happens if I change this to an array? What if someone's passing in an array to your method? Boom. Collection was of a fixed size. So arrays are read-only. Kind of a misnomer because technically arrays aren't read-only. You can change their values, right? But it is what you need to check. So right down here, I would need to say contract.requires... not strings that is read only. Okay, so this is the thing I came across that it didn't click in my head that an array could be read only. And I was trying to write a with method. You know, it would be kind of cool to have an array of something to say, you know, these strings dot with and add another string to it without having to pop it out into a list. So my original version of this didn't have the isReadOnly. And by the way, this is wrong. Do not copy this code. I'm going to show you why it's wrong in a second. If it was an I collection, which the array would be, then I was converting it to, if it's not an I collection, I'm going to convert it to a list, and I'm going to add something to it. Now, the first problem with this code is this is taking in an IEnumerable of T. This is an extension method on IEnumerable of T. However, I'm actually checking to see if this is an I collection of T. So I'm violating list call substitution principle, first thing. Second thing, this causes side effects. This is not good. So let's go up here, get rid of the find the bug part. And I'm going to say var strings 2 equals strings.with that's how I spell it. Is that right? This is Hello Den Hog. Okay. Cool. Let's see if this works. Okay, so if we don't have a side effects, strings should just say this is. And strings.with or strings2 should say this is Hello Den Hog. Let's check strings2 first to make sure the method's actually working. Hey, it does work. Cool. And let's check strings. That works as well. No side effects because we're using an array. So if I change this back to a list of string and then run it, I just mutated the original sequence. That's bad. I should not be mutating the original sequence. You may have stateful objects in your system. I'm assuming we're all business developers. We write business code. And you're not going to get around changing or mutating the state of of objects. However, whenever you're dealing with immutable types, particularly sequences, you should really avoid this. And in fact, I would recommend trying to go for immutable unless it doesn't make sense for performance reasons. So we need to fix this. And the problem with doing this way is that we're not taking advantage of the way IEnumerable T's work. Whenever we are returning an IEnumerable T, what we should be doing is using yield return. Yield return is going to create an iterator behind the scenes, which will pop everything out. And this will prevent these types of side effects. So whenever you see this right here, consider using yield return. So I'm going to get rid of all this. That's crazy. I'm going to say for each var t in item, actually source, okay, so we're going to yield each item out of the source and then finally yield the last item that's there. Actually, the code looks pretty clean, too, compared to what we had before. So I can go back over here, and I'm going to run it. No more side effect. Side effect is gone. Now, the reason you should avoid unintentional side effects, you shouldn't be writing to properties on objects unless they need to be written to. If it can be made a static method, you should consider doing that. Is that whenever you are changing things, it's possible another coder is going to come behind you and change things as well and cause bugs. So avoiding mutating the state is a good practice. All right, so the thing is that we're usually trying to strive for high cohesion, right? That's one of the principles out there, strive for high cohesion. There are a few other forms of cohesion. There is coincidental cohesion. Any of you guys have utility classes in your code base? You don't want to admit it? Okay, so a utility class or coincidental cohesion is where the methods in the class aren't really related to each other. You just put a lot of things in there for easy access. There's a next step in cohesion, and that's logical cohesion. That's where we have helper classes. That's where we have a static class that, say, operates only on strings. So logical cohesion is better than coincidental cohesion. It's still not what we're striving for. What we really want is functional cohesion. This method belongs to this object. So to start off with, I have console.writeLine string.isNorEmptyS. What's it going to write on the screen? True. I've always asked myself, why can't I ask the object or the string? Why can't I ask the string, hey, are you null or empty? Or why can't I ask an object, hey, are you null? There's an exception? Extension methods. Here's the important thing about extension methods. They exist on a static class, and they are static methods themselves. So whenever the compiler sees it, it's going to actually redirect it to the appropriate place. This method, whereas it appears to be on string, isn't really on string. However, it can be used to clean up your code and give your code functional cohesion. And we will get into that right now. By the way, so this extension method, I declare it by saying this, and it needs to be a static method inside of a static class. And it's going to extend whatever this variable is. If you already have helper classes in your projects, you can pretty much go through those methods and put this on it, or as the on the first parameter. So string.isNorEmpty source. That's really a trick. You know, I just wanted to show it to explain extension methods. What I really want to show you is how you can use those to clean up your code. So let's look at the file.txt I'm going to be working on. I have pirates beat ninjas. Well, we know pirates don't beat ninjas, right? Yeah, they don't beat ninjas. World, hello, backwards am I. We need to reverse this. So I've written a program that's already rather declarative. You should see the imperative version. It's about 25 lines long. And very hard to read. But this declarative version isn't too bad. We're going to read all the lines. Then we're going to run a projection on those lines. We're going to say each line, you know, split it up by the commas, reverse it around, assign it to our reverse sequence. And then we're going to write them back out. So Bob Martin in his book, Clean Code, states that functions, which are, you know, in this case methods, functions should be short. This is pretty short. It's 3 lines long. It's better than the 25 line long version. The second rule for methods or functions is they should be shorter. Well, let's make this as short as possible. Again, I'm going to copy this because I want you to see the before and after. Okay, file.readAllLines, file.txt, you should really make this a constant. This is a demo. And then we're going to do a select. Well, this isn't really necessary as it is. So let me cut this out. Let's cut this out. However, I really need to call file.writeAllLines with the reversed. So that's not cool. I really need another variable here. I need a reverse variable. I don't really like making variables for no reason at all. What I should be doing is asking the sequence, hey, write yourself out. Okay. So all strings, any enumerable string can write itself out now. And then we look over here, and we have string.join, comma, l.split, comma, reverse. shouldn't have to ask the string, or I shouldn't have to call string.join to do this. I should be able to ask the string or any enumerable strings to delimit themselves. Cool. Let's run this, make sure it works. Here's my file.txt, ninjas beat pirates. One line of code. One line. Oh, I'm not finished. I'm not finished. Hold your... Yes. Sir? The delimit? This right here? What do you want to know about it? Okay, I'll go show you how this works. Delimit is an extension method on an enumerable of string. And I can pass a parameter to it if I want a delimiter, or I can take the default delimiter of comma. So any enumerable strings can delimit themselves. And again, it's just making a pass through to string.join. And I have another extension method for write, so I can write them out. Any string should be able to write themselves out. I shouldn't have to call a static method on file to do so. So I'm going to call file.writeAllLines. And I don't know if this is really necessary in the modern framework. Yeah, probably get rid of that. There's an overload for writeAllLines now that takes an enumerable string instead of an array. The reason I'm not finished with this is because I think this line of code right here is complex. It's not too bad. I mean, I can read it. L.split, comma, reverse delimit. You know, I can figure it out. But again, it's one of those things that I may need to reuse in my code base. Anytime you have a projection like this that looks reusable, you should consider extracting it. So I'm going to extract the projection now. I want to give it a name that makes sense. I'm going to say delimited reverse. I'm going to go back to my enumerable string extensions, where I'm keeping every single method that pertains to enumerable string. I really do recommend you group your extension methods like that, because it's still a helper class. You can still call the static version if you desire. And I can say public static enumerable string delimited reverse. Laptop's running a little slow. Okay, strings. Okay, so we're going to create this delimited reverse extension method now. I'm going to put curly braces. And the only thing I'm going to do is I'm going to take that select statement, the projection, we're projecting from one sequence to another. I'm just going to paste it in. I'm making a pass-through to link the objects. Okay, so strings.select, L goes into L.split, comma, reverse.delimit. Now, since, by the way, if you ever do this with iQueryables, this is using the Lambda version, so it will translate properly. Now, the cool thing about doing this is if there's a performance issue, there shouldn't be for linked objects, but if there's a performance issue and you need to speed it up, you can actually go in here and modify this, and the only thing that matters is that it's returned the appropriate enumerable string. You can test this, and you can reuse it inside your framework. So file.readAllLines, delimited reverse. Let's make sure everything compiles and runs. Okay, so we're good. So let me ask you, which is easier for you to read? Which is easier for you to maintain if someone else writes it? Or if you go back to your own code 6 months later? Because I'm telling you, that used to be a problem. I'm always like, who wrote this? Oh, it was me. Great. Look at this version right here. File.readAllLines, delimited reverse, write. And then this version right here. Which would you prefer to see? The first one. Somebody likes the second one better. Okay. So the cool thing about all of this is that, you know, it allows us to make a very declarative DSL for ourselves. And this is reusable. It works with any enumerable strings. Actually, yeah, this works with any enumerable strings. I may need delimited reverse in, you know, in some other part of my project. And if I ever have to change it, then it'll change it everywhere. So I won't have to go picking through my project finding every single lambda expression that looks like this one particular lambda expression. There are several variations on this. There's abstract projections, abstract filters for the where clauses. You know, sometimes we might want to reduce the chain. We may have about three methods inside this chain, and we only want to, you know, we want to name those three methods because we're calling them continuously in different places. I do want to mention one thing about writing fluent interfaces, and that's I don't really believe that you should use extraneous verbs like and. It doesn't really add much to the context. Some people are trying to make things read like English, or maybe Dutch, but the thing about it is it doesn't really mean anything. It's just extra garbage, and we can actually read code, right? We don't need it to say, and do this, and do this. Okay, so I'm going to go to the craziest thing possible now. This is actually a little outside the scope in that it may be a little more high level or maybe lower level. Maybe a little more difficult to understand. I'm actually going to go back to my slide deck here and go near the end. Okay, if you understand link, this shouldn't be too hard to decipher, right? You know, var result from x in object 1, from y in object 2, select x plus y. What can you guys tell me about OBJ1? Huh? Not exactly. I think this gentleman up here might have had like the common answer. It's a sequence of some sort, enumerable t. Okay, so you would assume that result is going to be an enumerable of whatever the expanded type of x plus y is, correct? If this were a C-sharp file, would it need a using clause? No? Most people would say it's using system.link or something like that, particularly on enumerable T. All of that's wrong, by the way. The only thing that you can tell me is that OBJ1 implements select many. I'm going to prove it right now. Okay, so we're going to go to custom query expressions program. What I've done here, let me rename this, spell it properly. I have a square function. X goes into x times x. I pass in 2, I get 4. I have a square root function. It calls x goes into math.squared x. So if I pass in 4, I get 2. Then I have a hypotenuse function. It takes in two variables, a height and a width. It's called the square root of the square of h plus the square of w. The height is 3, the width is 4. The hypotenuse is going to be 5. So down here I call the hypotenuse function, height and width. I'm going to write it out to the screen. Okay. So there are no using clauses at the top for system.link. There's just system. I am going to comment this out. I'll say var hypotenuse equals from hn square from wn square select square root h plus w. No enumerable T. It's working on functions. And it still works. What's that? I'm sorry? The performance difference? Okay, so the first version up here, the hypotenuse, this is the, you know, the normal way of writing a function, where I'm combining other functions together. In this example down here, I'm using linked, the query expression syntax, to combine functions together. The way I'm doing this is I have an extension method called selectMany. Now, know that you don't actually need extension methods if you actually have control over the source code for the object or the class. But this is the way it looks. It's kind of crazy, I know. This part right here was much more difficult to write than this part right here. I didn't write it, you know, I didn't just sit down and bang this out. I actually had to think about this a little bit. It's kind of crazy. X comma Y goes into selector, left func, and then right func. And there's another overload you can make for this if someone's going to call the extension method version rather than query expressions. But the query expression syntax requires a very specific set of parameters. So I'm having to call right func, passing in X, and then passing in Y on the result. And this allows me to combine any two functions together. I can select from H in this, from W in this, or X in some one, you know, one function, Y in another function, and add them together, or do whatever I want to with them from that point on. And then I could add other extension methods like you know, where, if there was a way to make things nullable between classes and value types. That would be a maybe monad. Don't worry about that name. It's beyond the context of this conversation. But it would be a maybe monad. And you can do some cool things, like I could add a sum extension method on there that will work great in VB but not C#. But you can actually call the sum method and create a summation function based upon another function. So there are some interesting things you can do with extension methods on functions. But the point of this is that you have control over the query expression syntax. I'm going to make linked to object right now in front of you. Linked to object, not linked to objects. Public static t2 select t, t2. We need to change it from one object type to another. Makes sense. This TObj, and we have to have a selector function. Basically, we're saying this takes in a type of T and it's going to return a type of T2. Name it selector. And then I can come down here and say return selector obj. Let's comment all this out because we don't really need it. From x in 2, it's an object, select x plus 1. Three. Very basic link to object. You can then go add all the extension methods. The query expression syntax works off of certain method names. And you can discover these method names by looking in the system.link namespace and look at what the extension methods are for innumerable of T. And then you can apply it to any object. They do not need to be extension methods. If you need to use, say, a parser, that parses one type, and you want to project it to parsing another type within a query expression, you can put a select method directly on it. Okay, so some of the refactorings we have, you know, we can assign things to initializers. We can change if else to null coalesce. We can reduce chains whenever we have a series of chain methods. We can give them a name and pass that chain in. And you do that only when you find yourself constantly using the exact same chain methods. We can name lambdas, which you saw inside of the one demo without parameters. And we can extract projection, extract filters, extract sorts. And that's really all I have, but I'm ready to open the floor for questions, and I can still do some crazy code in front of you guys. Thank you. All right, any questions? Yes, sir, in the back. That's true. It would, if you had read-only writes to the file so you could not write to it, it will fail. It's the same thing that would happen if you just called file.writeAllLines to the file and you had read-only writes. The interesting thing about taking this extension method, let me go back to that. That was under functional. Numeral string extensions. So I put this in an extension method, and I'm piping through directly to file.writeAllLines. If I really wanted better error checking or better error handling, I could put it directly in that method. So it gives me control over it, and I don't have to repeat that code anywhere. Anyone else? Yes, sir. And then you have a conflict. I believe the best way to handle that is probably through process, maybe enforcing the extension methods on these types go in this particular file. If people are putting extension methods everywhere, you're definitely going to run into that problem. Certainly. So that's more of a question of standards within the organization, of where they put things. Now, you may have certain libraries where the extension methods pertain to one thing. Like maybe I have a web library with extension methods that pertain only to web methods. Like I have extensions on strings that parse HTML or something like that. So in that case, if someone doesn't realize it's there, they could put it in the other place as well. And if you have projects combining those two libraries, you should get an exception. It shouldn't compile because it won't know which one to go to if they're both in scope. That's your question. I did promise you guys one trick. If I go back up to my declarative code and I'm writing these out, calling for each everywhere just to write things out to the console seems kind of crazy. So I'm going to come down here and I'm going to say public, this is because I don't feel like adding the class at the moment, public static class extensions, public static void run this enumerable of t. Let me do that. This enumerable t is source, action t. Yeah, I need my generic definition. And Now we can say for each var item in source action item. It's basically a for each extension method. This extension method exists in a better form with, you know, a little better checking into it, maybe a few enhancements for performance inside of Rx, reactive extensions. But it's very simple to write for yourself if you don't feel like bringing it in. So now I can come down here. I can get rid of, actually I just want to get rid of this part. So let's say I need to get rid of this variable now. I don't really need it anymore. Let's say ninjas, where the ninja doesn't have the clothes, then we can just run. Same thing as doing a for each loop without having to create extra variables and slightly more declarative in nature. Still works. That's a little handy extension method for you guys. Okay, 5 more minutes. Any more questions? Gentleman in the back. There is a method on list to do for each, but you do have to make it a list before you can run that extension or that method. I would say that's probably more performant in that case, particularly if it's a large sequence. Okay, so the reason Microsoft didn't put for each on the original enumerable T was because they don't really consider it very, what's the correct word? It doesn't really fit into the whole context of link. Everything in link is really returning a type out of it. Now, run is creating a side effect. We are intentionally doing something inside of here. In this case, I'm writing out to the console. That is a side effect, technically. And since it doesn't really fit into the whole context of link, they left it out. There's also the problem that if you have a for each method, well, does it run immediately or is it deferred execution? Because this where right here, this is deferred. It doesn't actually iterate over that list or that sequence until I do something with it. And that's why I really don't believe there should be a for each method. There may be one one day. But right now, what I think is that you should have a run and you should have something like iterate to have deferred execution. That really fits the context a little bit better and actually describes what you're doing. Because consider this, every extension method so far that I've put on enumerable T, I'm doing a for each over it. This is technically a for each loop that's filtering. A projection is a for each loop that's, you know, changing one type to another. So for each isn't very descriptive. So that's why they didn't put it in the original version, in the original linked objects. And I don't think there's one existing or nowadays either. Let's try it. No, it's not there. All right. Any more? Sir? Oh, I think that's actually a great name. And the only reason I use the run syntax is because that's what's inside reactive extensions, and I figured most people would be familiar with it. However, if you come from a jQuery background, you would be more familiar with the each method, right? So we could do each. Now, again, I don't think that's very descriptive since it's for each, they're about the same thing. And I would actually change the each version to do this right here. Okay, so instead of having run, we would have each. And if we do each, we need to return the type back out. It's going to have enumerable T. Yes, and down below, well, I guess right here, we need to do this yield return item. So I would run the action, then you'll return it. This gives you deferred execution, and that makes more sense from naming it each. In Rx, it's called iterate. I believe that's correct. All right. Any more questions? So thank you very much, guys. It's been a great session. Have a good one.